Well, what a very awkward dinner party moment that was. So we are in the Gospel according to John today, and Jesus is welcomed into the home of some very good friends of his, three siblings, Lazarus, and his two sisters, Martha and Mary, and they live in a town, really more of a village, Bethany. Bethany is just east of Jerusalem. And as you just heard, in the middle of supper, Mary gets down on her knees and anoints the feet of Jesus with a pound of expensive ointment, about a cup and a half of pure nard, that is very high quality perfume. And she wipes this substance on his feet with her hair. I imagine it is very hard for us to imagine the acute social embarrassment that this scene created. The lavishing of expensive perfume on Jesus' feet was outlandish enough, and we'll say a bit more about that in a second. But in the very socially conservative milieu of first century Palestine, for a woman to let down her hair in front of anybody beyond immediate family, much less in the presence of a rabbi, and then to use that hair in this manner to anoint feet, as I've said before, this was as shocking as if Mary of Bethany had gotten on the supper table, hiked up her dress, and shown off a brand new tattoo on her thigh. It's a very awkward dinner moment indeed. It's a strange thing that she does here, an extravagant gesture, highly sensual, let's face it. Certainly not the comportment one would expect at dinner with a religious leader. It is not the comportment one would expect here at St. George's, is it? And yet, there is something disarmingly spontaneous and beautiful in Mary's unexpected action here that seems to me like just self-abandonment in adoration. Some of you, maybe a lot of you, saw last year's hit movie, A Star is Born, the remake of A Star is Born, right? Starring Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper. We just watched it in my household, rented the film. Susie Lee told me her interest had nothing at all to do with Bradley Cooper, and I believe her. He plays this rugged, charming, yet hard-living country singer who discovers and falls in love with Lady Gaga's character. One of the film's most memorable scenes is very, very brief. He drops her off in his chauffeured black SUV, and as she walks away from the vehicle, Cooper's character rolls down the window, and he looks at her for a second, and then he calls out, "Hey." She stops walking and glances back and says, "I just wanted to take another look at you. I just wanted to take another look at you." That was a terrible Bradley Cooper imitation from the movie. But Susie Lee often asks me to do that. No, I'm just kidding. So, I don't know why, but I'm kind of embarrassed that I use that as a sermon analogy. But anybody who's ever been madly in love connects with that scene, which is why it's in the trailer. We all get it. We all want to be on the receiving end of that kind of statement. And if we're passionately in love, we will give it. A kind of impulsive, uninhibited, expressive love here today between Mary of Bethany and Jesus. Of course, it's an entirely different kind of love. This is not romantic love here. What Mary does here is an expression of worship. It is a liturgical act. And here too, as in the film, by the way, a departure, a separation is happening. In the theological structure of John's gospel, this episode prefigures the death of Jesus. Mary, you see, is symbolically preparing Jesus for his burial. Indeed, the only time such nard, such expensive perfume, would have ever touched the feet of another person, the feet would be at the time of burial. And that is exactly what women will do when they take Jesus down from the cross. And it is coming soon. Lent is approaching its climax. The next meal in John's gospel is the Last Supper. There is a kind of gathering darkness as the story heads to that point, some kind of an inevitability. So let's place this dinner engagement for today in its proper gospel context, because you will recall that this is the same household where, preceding this dinner today, Jesus had raised Mary's brother, Lazarus, from the dead. Mary knows that this one who reclines at supper in her home is the Lord who has the power to raise the dead. She saw it with her own eyes, this incredible, explosive moment of revelation. But he is also dear friend, now nested within her ordinary home, present in a shared meal. How can this be? How can we put those two things together? I just have to believe that Mary is hearing all the chatter from neighbors in the village and from the countryside. She knows what people are saying. She suspects strongly that Jesus is in fact headed towards some final conflict. And I strongly suspect also that Mary of Bethany imagines this will be the very last time that she will be with Jesus, and she is practically undone by it. How to express her love, her gratitude, and her devotion? By pouring out what is probably the most valuable gift that she possesses. Again, a symbolic liturgical action of the body, of bowing down, of offering, of humility, of gratitude, of loving devotion. And this fragrance fills the house. I always feel a little personally convicted when I encounter this gospel story, because I wonder, when was the last time that I demonstrated such generous self-abandonment to Jesus? Perhaps like you, I often approach Jesus hoping he will lavish gifts on me. He does. We call it grace. But I always want more. More safety, more success, health, my problems to evaporate. The risk of sharing a bit too much of my personal piety, one of the things that I do to communicate with God, like many if not all of you, is I say prayers at the end of the day, and the last thing I do is I go outside on our porch to do that before I retire to the bedroom at the end of the evening, and almost always the day that is passing had not gone exactly as I wanted it to. And I have a list of things that I wish God would sort of intervene and unwind or fix. And I decided during Lent that I would try to not do any of that, but simply look at the night sky and say, thank you, Jesus. More of you. Just simple praise and adoration. And that is an easier resolution to make than it is to fulfill. Because there are a lot of evenings, maybe even most, I don't feel like praising Jesus. I want some praise myself. You do something for me. But that's precisely the source of praise. And the desire to praise Jesus, I think, is praise. And I think it pleases him. Well, Judas speaks up now. Where did he come from? How did he even get a part in the scene here? Well, he did. He's thrown into this fragrant aroma, this heartwarming dinner, like a stink bomb. The notorious, treacherous disciple asks, why in the world would anyone waste this expensive perfume in this way? Why was this perfume not sold for 300 denarii? And the money given to the poor. And of course, as the text shares, Judas is insincere. He would sell the perfume and keep the money for himself. But he is a caricature, for us, of the one who knows the price of everything and the value of nothing. His presence at the macro level is the personification of evil that invades even the sanctuary of this intimate gathering, this supper among friends, this relationship that we enjoy with Jesus. But we might also hear in him that familiar voice of pragmatism, of lowest common denominator, utilitarian spirituality. Is this really the highest and best use of our time, of our resources? Goodness, how often have I said something like that around the church? And Jesus says, the poor you will always have with you. You will not always have me. What value is the church? What good is it really doing? Is it filling my needs? Is it keeping up with the times? Do I have time for such a commitment as it's asking? How long did that service last? Did you get anything out of the sermon? Did you like those hymns? Why doesn't the church quit doing X? And why doesn't the church start doing more of Y? And Jesus might say, all these questions you will always have with you. You may not always have me. Of course, there is nothing here in the gospel that suggests Mary is indifferent to the plight of the poor or any of the other callings to which Jesus' followers commit themselves. But her posture, down on her knees in this lavish act of simple love, reinforces a strong belief that I often communicate here, and it is this. Praise and worship, whether we feel like it or not, is the font. It is the source. It is the origination. It is the inspiration for all of the other callings of us to one another and out into the world. That is to say that I believe that Christian communities that are most committed to worship are those that end up doing the most good in the world. Because you rarely start with do-goodism and end up at the feet of Jesus or the foot of the cross. What you end up with is works righteousness and a lot of burnout and frustration when you do realize that the poor you will always have with you, and the rich too. And that is why we invest so much in the ministry here of worship. Jesus is worth it. And ultimately, whether we are fully aware of it or not, it changes us, and that is a gift to others that we go forth to serve. The great 20th century Anglican spiritual writer Evelyn Underhill once wrote that the tendency in all worship, by which she really meant the Christian life, is to decline from adoration to demand. And that downhill pull must be resisted, the move from adoration to demand. And we might hear ourselves slipping down that hill if ever we say to somebody something like this: after all the love I've shown for you, and you do this to me, you act like that? Jesus never, ever does that. John's gospel is about to show us that our redemption is costly. Our worship here is a way of giving order and beauty and majesty to that, to this thing that is about to happen to Jesus, this disordered and ugly and sordid event, his crucifixion, whereby his life is offered and ours is gained. And so with Mary of Bethany bowing down and pouring out the most precious possession she has, we too here ritualize our gratitude and our praise. That's what we're fundamentally doing right now. What is it to be human, really fully alive? It is to see all reality in relation to God in Christ and to pour out our lives into that reality praise and thanksgiving. And so Mary of Bethany is a figure for us. Jesus is not a skill. Jesus is not a sentiment. Jesus is not a new understanding that is helpful to us. Jesus is an event that happens to us, a relationship, a new world born of nothing more, but nothing less than our recognition, our faith, that the God of creation comes into our house, into our lives, into our hearts as Jesus to love us and die for us. The impractical blessing of worship, of freely giving praise as a portal into that world, a fragrant offering and reality where the death of Jesus means life for us.